1269.
Welcome to the SDS conferencing system. There are two other parties in this conference.
From the depths of Lake Michigan, remote viewing from Chicago's northwest side, this is Vintage Cop with Jazz Maz, exclusively on Anon Radio. Now, here's Jazz.
There are five other
Okay.
Conference.
Well, welcome. You are listening to Vintage Comp on Anon Radio.
With SMJ.
And Jazz Maz.
And JWH.
Wow. Oh, and JWH, holy heck.
Hey, JWH.
Hey.
Wow, cutting it really close there. I have my dinner is in the oven, and it's about 27 minutes out, which is yeah.
So we may be hearing some noms to go with my slurping of coffee.
Maybe so. Yeah.
Or we'll some, see. Oh, damn, it burned.
Nah, it won't burn. It'll shut off. So anywho, wow, cool. Everybody's welcome to Vintage Comp, and we got a whole slew of people here. And for some reason, JWH decided to join in, which is very cool. That's a rare thing.
Rare treat, rare surprise.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I never owned like a TI. Or a Commodore, well, not counting the Amiga, so I never really thought I had anything really to contribute to those previous shows that were about my first IBM PC clone I bought from an outfit in South Carolina called Wells American. That was back in about 1987. But ever since then, every other desktop computer that I have owned, I built myself. So I have
six other parties.
So you're talking about the teaser about let's build a PC. The whole thing that's like.
You mean that was a lie?
No, it's not a lie, because I think that's kind of people are getting interested in building their own PCs now. Mm-hmm. There was a while where PCs, not just Macintosh, were sort of a commodity, you know, consumer appliance.
Right, that you could pretty much buy a end-to-end machine already pre-built and configured, and it would be powerful enough for the average consumer.
Right. And then, of course, with desktop PCs, it's really easy for me to open it. I don't need a Torx wrench. I don't need, like, a pry bar. I can get in there. I can swap out the hard drive. I can swap out the...
Yeah, zero-tool replacement chassis and things like that, yeah.
So, I mean, there was at least that, but still people, like, with the E-machines and the, you know, HP Pavilion and... stuff like that, people were still buying an appliance, essentially. They weren't buying the AT case or the ATX case or the motherboard and the memory and all the separate things and all kind of piecing it together, buying the package. And maybe you do get a discount. Maybe you get value-added services, like a warranty.
Warranty.
Yeah, but anywho.
Isn't that something you void?
So, void it in a way. So, but I guess it goes along with Robert 588's post about his AT&T PC that he posted, where he's been 3D printing
replacement
adapters. Yeah,
brackets.
Replacement parts and adapters and stuff like that. So, anywho, tell JWH, since you have a story, tell us about PCs that you have bought and assembled all by yourself.
Well, Well, let me just back up a little bit and say that, you know, why do you build it yourself? And one answer that
there are
probably
seven
pops,
other parties in
pops
this conference.
Into people's minds is to say money. But that's really, I mean, that can happen, but that's not really the top reason why I have done it over all these years. In my case, the motivation is to get to be able to choose all the components. It kind of dates back to, you know, my hi-fi and stereo stuff. You know, mm-hmm. I would want to buy speakers from a company that I know makes good speakers, and I would buy a turntable from a company that makes good turntables, and I would buy an amplifier from a company that makes good amplifiers, and I would put them all together myself, and I would wire them all up together, and you know, that was the thing. And that, you know, carried on over into the computer world, because I would buy from a red card company, buy a sound card from a good sound card company. I would buy RAM from a good RAM company, and a motherboard from a good motherboard company, and a, you know, a good case from a good case company, and put them all together myself. And I would have a system that knew everything that was in it. And I had chosen them by comparing them against their competitors and so on. And I had faith that it was a good thing, rather than buying some pig in a poke that, you know, Dell or who's the other one? What was the one with the cow motif? Gateway, yeah. You know, you could buy a computer from those guys, and it would probably be okay, but you might run into a problem with it, and you would have no idea where the problem was, how to fix it, whatever. It was all kind of a black box. So,
well,
I don't know.
I mean, you. But the thing with Dell and Gateway is that they
started out as early white box manufacturers that were actually fairly upgradable.
Well, yeah, I've seen the first generation of Dell stuff, and it is basically just a total knockoff of the AT.
Mm-hmm.
IBM AT case. I forgot their name before they were Dell, but I don't know if it matters. Anyways, down in Texas. But the thing with Dell and Gateway is that it's value added, that
mm-hmm.
meaning that there's probably a 1-800 number you could call and say, hey, my machine is serial number such and such. I can't, my floppy drive don't work. What wrong? So it could be that.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I will admit that because I was a professional computer programmer, and you know, I had education in computer technology, so I had a leg up over just, you know, John Q computer user. So
sure.
that's the difference.
Yeah. Right, exactly. And building your own machine and selecting the parts, you kind of customize it in the way you want, and then you probably do save some money. But then again, all the support falls back on you, and since you put it together, you kind of know, you know, where to start looking when something's not working. So,
right.
But I think that for a long time, and I'm not even talking about Heathkit and stuff like that, which is I don't compare putting together a PC with ready-made parts versus soldering all the boards in a kit.
Right, kit computer versus a field upgradable computer.
Yeah, those are two different levels. I mean, both teach you a lot about what you're doing, you know, and, oh, yeah, having to configure interrupts on ISA boards. I mean, that's an education all in itself, right? You're just like, oh, what's an interrupt? It's like
interrupts and addresses.
Interrupts and addresses on the ISA bus. It's like, that's the first thing. But you learn a lot. And some of it is easily demystified, and some of it is sort of like, gosh, what? I have to figure this out again? So it kind of goes back to the idea of the value-added reseller,
mm-hmm.
like Dell or Gateway.
Right, that they can help you solve your problems if you have to configure it in a non-standard way.
Well, I see why your COM port's no longer working. It's because you installed that board, which stole the interrupt, and you have interrupt priority on that slot, blah, 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 blah.
Right, your COM port is now superseding your floppy controller.
Exactly. So.
I still can't get my COM port to work on that one PC.
on your what?
On my PC XT. clone.
COM ports are overrated. Get yourself a parallel port Ethernet adapter for it. And then
I think I've got,
if I don't, I've got a friend that probably has a box of...
Zircoms?
Zircom parallel port adapters.
Yes, those are the magical adapters. Zircom.
It's really disappointing because I just don't have enough computers that I can use to connect online with.
Yeah. Ethernet might be cheating a little bit, but
I don't even want a computer. I just want a terminal that just dumps all the bits as it scrolls off the screen. It's like, I don't care. Don't store those bits for me. Delete all log files, please.
Like an old Wang.
Well, okay. Yeah, cool.
Anyone else have any interesting early PC build-your-own system stories?
I have a revisited PC story. When I moved up to Washington State, I worked for a company called Metapath. Yes, and our business was basically CDR mediation for the wireless carriers, call detail record mediation between the various switches. And at this company, it was a very Unix focused company, and that's kind of why I was able to get a job there. When IT came around and said, hey, we'll build you a desktop, do you want Unix or do you want Windows? And I said, I want Unix. and then I said, can I put NetBSD on it? And they were like, no, they were fine with it.
Oh, really? Good.
They let me put NetBSD on the corporate network, and I could even talk to the mail server if I wanted to. They trusted it that much. Anyways, when I moved on from the company, even before I moved on with the company, when they decided to surplus this vintage machine, they let all the employees have their workstation, or they would just take it away and recycle it.
Mm-hmm.
So I have my 1996 GLI piece. It's a Pentium 2. But the whole reason why I brought it out of the closet is because I want to write RX50 disks for my deckmate.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's in the picture on Mastodon on the left side. The left side is my PC from 1996.
Nice.
A picture of it today. And then the picture on the right side is SDF in 1991.
I must be looking at the wrong Mastodon picture.
The what?
I said I just must be looking at the wrong Mastodon picture.
A case full of floppy disks.
That's my PC.
That's as it is today.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. Yes, I want to get
disk storage.
I want to get those datas off of those floppies, and I'm trying to decide, do I want to install DOS 6.2? Do I want to install FreeDOS? Do I want to install Windows 95? It's still running NetBSD 2, I think 2 or 1.4.
Get a FreeDOS boot disk and try it.
Yeah.
I did. I just got to play with it a little bit more. I just want to make sure I have access to the network and I can run Teledisk. The disk FX machine. The picture of SDF from 1991 is, you can see the old Apple II BBS. This is actually Ted's room. You can see the Apple II BBS. You can see the four telephone lines on the wall.
Yeah.
And there's like modems piled up behind the Apple II. And then there's a black case, and then there's a beige case. And the beige case is the original 386 SDF. And Ted was moving that into the black case underneath it that Aaron Schmiedel had provided. The Apple II wasn't actually running the BBS at this time in 1991. It was there, and it would answer the phone if if the Unix system was down.
Mm-hmm.
So it would answer the first line on the Rotary Hunt group, 4363281, and it would just basically say, you know, the system's down, we're doing hardware upgrades. But that's what's in the pictures there. And the floppy disks, I don't know, I'm guessing those are probably the Magic City Micro BBS
mm-hmm.
stuff. That's what it ran on the disk twos. And the reason why there's a joystick there is that, you know, those joysticks on the Apple had, they were centering, right?
Yeah.
And you could tweak the center so that the joystick was always like in an XY coordinate that was not zero.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you did that, then for some reason the chat wouldn't be enabled. So we had chat disabled, chat with the sysop disabled.
Because of the joystick.
Because of the joystick, yeah. So
were the Apple II joysticks mapped into the keyboard, or?
Oh, I don't know.
Because I don't remember. I haven't really used too many joysticks on an actual Apple II back in the day, or today for that matter. I have a few. But I know that was a common technique of interfacing joysticks, that they would matrix them into the keyboard, and
yeah.
So long as you weren't sending data, well, those are analog sticks, right? So they would probably have
yeah.
to have something else.
It is analog.
Do something else to interface them, but like digital joysticks, you know, mapping them, you know, basically matrixing them into the keyboard array
right.
was a common trick. And the issue was you could use the keyboard or you could use the joystick, but not both at the same time, usually.
Oh.
Like, if you've ever played with, like, Commodore 64 with a joystick in port 1, it does weird things to your
yeah.
character output. And you can also mess with keyboard input on port 2 if you hold the stick in a direction.
When I got my Commodore 128, you know, first time.
It's like,
why is it
booting into why is it dumping into the monitor ROM? Like, oh, that's because the book is laying on your joystick.
I had just done some work on my Commodore 128 to get it working, and
uh-huh.
you know, I turned it on, and I'm like, oh crap, the keyboard just went out. You know, I was
like,
really frustrated, and I'm like, wait a minute, and I unplugged the joystick, and then the keyboard was fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thankfully, on the PC Junior, apparently the joystick ports are totally different from the keyboard,
mm-hmm.
Which is a real plus because, you know, about keyboard overruns on the PC
mm-hmm.
Junior, it's a big problem.
Yeah.
If you're trying to use the floppy disk, writing to the floppy disk
mm-hmm.
or reading from the floppy disk, you
can
do
something.
There's
right.
no keyboard buffer. But the joysticks are not...
Mm-hmm.
They've got
a dedicated interface, yeah.
Which is good. That's another plus for the PC Junior that everybody
sure.
hates.
Yeah. It's not. They hate it because it's not an IBM PC, and it was never really intended to be. It was intended to have some level of compatibility, but it was really intended to be a home computer, not a cost reduced business computer.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, maybe they would have benefited by not calling it the PC Junior. But I mean, at the same time, it's like, it's the PC Junior.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah, it's really hard to do that. But on the, let's see, more about that 1991 picture. I'm trying to use AI Enhance on it. The telephone numbers are all written on the little boxes. You can't read them, but they're all 436 numbers. And they were not sequential, but it was in a Rotary Hunt group, so that if you called any number, actually, it would... I think originally, if you called any number, it would hunt to the rest in the group, but we didn't like that because we wanted dedicated... UUCP numbers, like for
mm-hmm.
PEP modems or, you know, 192 telebit modems and things like that. So
sure.
We were able to get back when you could call the business office at the telephone company and actually talk to somebody. They
oh, yeah.
made it so that only one number did the hunt. If numbers were busy, it would hunt through a group.
Right.
So, but if you called any individual number outside the hunt group, you could get that
right, that individual line,
yeah.
Right.
So,
and if it was busy, you were just out of luck. You'd try it again.
Right, and I remember the cost on these lines without having... I'm sorry, this was GTE. This wasn't Southwestern Bell. At Southwestern Bell, we were able to get 9 phone lines with a direct dial and a hook group, but metered service on all the lines. So they were all like $9.99 a month. It's like, so we had dial-ups for $9.99 a month, all in it. And maybe like someone with a PRI, well, I don't think they'd have a PRI at those days, but a T1 with Channel Bank or whatever, 24 channels. They probably would, I don't know what they would have gotten for, I don't know. Maybe
metered
we did
service.
Have a killer deal.
Metered service meant a per minute charge, right?
Yeah, for dial out. So that meant that it was basically like, you know, insert a 25 cents to make your call.
Right.
But to receive calls,
it was
not metered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a flat connection. That was common back in the day, that usually they didn't bill per minute for incoming calls. That was the the other end would get billed for that if it was a toll call.
And I found out about that because it was I was looking at things like food stamps and, you know, other ways to kind of subsidize living expenses. And I found out that if somebody calls you, you don't get charged.
Right.
And if you get a particular type of service. And I can't remember how I found this out, but I thought, wow, that's perfect, because SDF's never going to be calling anybody else. People are going to be calling SDF.
Yep.
So, you know, we went from like $24 a month for an individual phone line down to $9 a month, which is a big savings, especially when you're just dealing with people making random donations.
But were you doing Usenet?
Yeah.
Well, then you were dialing up, or were you always being dialed?
No. We had what we could do is there was a poll method, and you Adaptec Corporation in Arlington and Southern Methodist University in Dallas had you could basically instigate a call and send them like a UECP packet. And if you had anything, you could disconnect the line, and they would call you back.
Right, ring some type of ring back service, right?
Yeah.
You ring ring their line. It would.
What it did in UECP is it called. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything in the telephone network.
Mm-hmm.
What it did with the UECP server is that you sent something and you disconnect the line.
I think at that point in time too, the billing was such that if you instigated a connection, a telephone call, and you kept it under like some number of small number of seconds, it would not be billed.
Well, that's possible, but I don't think we took advantage of something like that. I mean, what we did is we would make the call, try to send something, and then we disconnect the call in mid-packet.
And then it would ring back,
No, it wouldn't ring back. What would happen would the other side would say, hey, I still have stuff for you. I'm going to try to call you.
Oh, I'm going to initiate a call and reestablish connection. Yeah. So not an actual ring back service, but an error correction recovery mode.
Yeah, basically that's what we would do. I just remember at some point it.
So you might get charged a nickel for the call, but not the per minute charge.
I don't remember that any. But Roy Neese, who was running Adaptec, or Adaptex was the name of the UCP host at Adaptec Corp.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, for like, you know, going on for like almost 3 years, SDF had like a pinned up connection with AdaptTech for free, basically just feeding us Usenet news. And that was during the time after 93 when...
Yeah, when it was no longer provided by your ISPs for free.
Well, we also knew that it was no longer like 10 megs a day.
Oh, yeah, that too, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you wanted the whole hierarchy.
Anyways, that's just my story from this picture. There's another thing in the corner. You see the blue bag in the lower right-hand corner. That is Steve Linebarger's smoky bag. That's what I call smoky bag. It was a vinyl bag, and he brought stuff over to Ted, and it just reeked of cigarette smoke, and it never stopped. Anyways, I'm going to go check my thing in the oven. You guys, I'll be right back.
Okay. So any other interesting stories about building your own PCs back in the day? Or should I share one?
Go ahead.
Share one.
Yeah.
Okay. So my first experience with building PCs was as sort of an after-school job. In my late high school days, I was on various local bulletin board services, primarily Commodore-based ones, because I was still using my Commodore 64 and 128 for an embarrassingly long time, being a kid with no money. and also I eventually got, 128 and the 1571 and 1581, so I could interchange data with PCs for quite a number of years once I got that. But I met a group of friends from the BBS community, like the NPR special that plays on and on radio every once in a while. BBS friends from the BBS days were in the local area and became friends in real life, right? So I met a few people on and off through the BBS community, and it turned out one of the guys' family actually owned a printing and mailing business about six blocks from where I live. And, part of that was they were using PCs to manage mailing databases and print labels for the printing and mailing and stuffing machine, and as well as some other custom stuff off of a laser printer. And the guy's brother would pick up all this older hardware at auctions and then bring it to his parents at one point in time. And they're like, can you do anything with this? And it's like, well, yeah, actually I can. So, they had to... had some better quality machine. They had a better quality machine that they had bought through a retail channel that ran the laser printer. But they always needed an extra machine. I think it ran the laser printer and it ran the Peachtree accounting system for the business, if anyone remembers that particular software package. So we'd have this sort of odds and ends that the business owner's other son would pick up at auction down in Florida somewhere. And when he'd come up to Chicago, he'd bring it with him. And it's like, okay, well, we can build some other machines because it's like, we don't need anything terribly advanced to print labels with continuous tractor-fed forms for the labels for the printing and mailing machine, because all they are just continuous paper white forms of a particular size that the machine actually cuts out, applies adhesive to, and glues them to the envelope as it stuffs them with information, leaflets. So it was like an end-to-end, printing and mailing machine. You basically take the tractor-fed output and feed it into the printing and into the tractor feed on the printing and mailing machine, and it would, die cut the labels out of the continuous form. and, you know, glue and apply them. So that was kind of an interesting machine. Also kind of temperamental, but the idea was that I was kind of employed part-time after school, keeping these machines running and constantly upgrading them from very old parts to slightly newer parts. And that was sort of one of my early experiences. And then the other one was someone gave me a 286 motherboard when he was in the process of upgrading. I think this would have been about the time that 386s were becoming common and 486s were beginning to emerge. And it kind of sat on the shelf because I didn't have any extra parts for that. But eventually, you know, I would gather enough parts. I think I still have the MiniScribe hard drive I used in that system. And, of course, it was the awful MFM variant that were notorious for stiction problems and other things, but, you know, kept it working. And, you know, basically it was sort of a piecemeal thing that I would, you know, get used parts from stuff. There used to be a business in the Hyde Park neighborhood of Chicago called Chicago Computer Exchange, and that was a good source for stuff because, you know, you had the university down there, and, you know, every season, you know, the rich kids would come in and they'd have new computers and they'd get rid of some of their old stuff on their way out at the end of the year.
Yeah, it's older hardware, but still
yeah.
good hardware.
You
might as well use it.
Yep.
Well, that's really how I got into computers. My dad did networking for libraries,
mm-hmm.
and whenever they would, you know, swap out a computer because it was broken or when they
mm-hmm.
upgraded or whatever, he would bring all the junk home and
yep.
I'd build computers with it.
Yeah, you'd take all the parts and find,
yeah.
eventually you'd end up with enough to actually build a working computer out of it. And that was kind of how I started as well.
Yeah.
After the home computer stuff, you know, eventually, you know, once a lot of people were distributing stuff on high-density floppy, the Commodore became less advantageous. You know, I could
yeah.
still read, load, you know, double-density disks and write double-density disks and interchange data that way, but if someone gave me something on high-density, I was kind of dead in the water.
Right.
Let's see here. Another interesting part of Chicago area, you know, parts generation, you know, parts building, build your own, you know, white box out of generic parts was, there were a number of computer shows that were held at small community colleges and universities. The one I particularly went to was, I think, labeled the Giant Computer Show out of the College of DuPage. And that was also probably one of the earliest Linux users groups that I was exposed to, because they would, you know, in the late stages of that computer show before they moved it to the county fairgrounds, they would meet there in a room.
Are they kaput now?
What, the Giant DuPage Computer Show or College of DuPage?
The DuPage show. Is it just COVID hiatus, or are they just dead?
Well, I think they're dead. I think the you know, like we were talking about earlier, we went through this phase of where building your own white box machine became less of a thing because you could buy a fairly powerful pre-built machine. And then largely the people that were building custom machines were largely people that were, you know, performance-oriented, either gamer, you know, high-end gaming or some special-purpose performance machine.
Video or something, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, video or audio processing, you know, multi-track audio, digital audio processing or something like that. So those shows kind of waned on their own over time, because I think that one, after it left the College of DuPage and went to the the county fairgrounds. It only lasted a couple more shows after that, and that was pretty much it. Today, you're probably more likely to go to a maker fair, although those seem to have kind of become less common, too, even pre-COVID. And then I guess there was, you know, the Rep Rap Fest. Yeah. What is that? Is that in Indiana? I forget. But, yeah, there are things like that that kind of replaced the sort of build-your-own-computer, became kind of, you know, maker fairs and 3D printing and things like that became kind of more of the interest later on. And computers became kind of more generic.
The last HamFest I went to, they still had a little bit of computer stuff available there. Not like years ago, but still.
Yeah, because a lot of us have scraped that stuff up over the years. You know, people that collect classic computer equipment, you know, realized at one point that that was an ideal place at one point in time to pick up old, used classic computer hardware, and therefore there's not as much of it there anymore.
Yeah, I got lucky. I grabbed a pile of old computers last weekend that were free and happened to only be two blocks from my house. But I saw an ad on Craigslist that was like, you know, got a bunch of 90s computer junk if anyone wants it. I was like, So I sent him a message, and he's like, yeah, I figured I'd check before I threw them all away.
And you know, this is something that the classic computer community here often talks about every once in a while, that at some point in time, you're going to have a generation of people that are going to be nostalgic for that first generation.
Yeah.
You know, Dell machine that they bought right when they went to college, or, you know, Gateway 2000.
Probably be when people are nostalgic.
I remember that computer that I bought from the Home Shopping Network.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Well, I did buy it. I bought something that was not supposed to be a computer, but was a computer from the Home Shopping Network.
Remember, what was it, Blue Hippo?
What was it? Call Tootie for the deal. Call Tootie for the deal on the Home Shopping Network. Hey, I got something.
Can you guess what the device is that I bought that was not supposed to be a computer but is a computer?
I was trying to think of what.
From the Home Shopping Network?
I don't know.
An internet appliance?
It was certainly not an internet appliance, although the eye openers were kind of interesting. I have a friend that has one of those. Think computer game. The C64 DTV units that were sold on Home Shopping Network,
yeah.
Which were essentially functionally a ASIC implementation of Commodore 64, plus or minus some features.
Is that the thing that launched Jerry Ellsworth into?
So, I guess Jens and Jerry had worked on the C1 before that, and some of the culmination of some of the technology and personal education that Jerry undertook to make that happen went into the DTV, along with some help from other members of the Commodore community.
Okay. Well, but just having having that on the Home Shopping Network is just like, you know, a home run anyway. It doesn't matter. It's just like, I did have one thing that kind of goes in line with this. The recent the news is always fickle about stuff like this, but just like what's happening to Facebook, losing $200 billion worth of value.
Couldn't have happened to a nicer entity. But
it's just like, hey, we told you guys.
You're doing what you're doing well. Don't change it.
No. I mean, we told you guys, everybody else.
Yeah.
That Facebook was kind of like, you know, it was a shill as far as what, but I don't know if, yeah, like, they're completely going to be tanked by this.
No, I don't think so. I think they've got enough wealth within the company that they'll recover. They may not, they may have some problems permanently as a result of that. In other words, if they've shook their investor confidence.
just for fun, I watched Ready Player One again, you know, post-meta.
I have not seen that. I have not read the book either.
Okay.
The DVR has recorded it for me, so one day I will watch it.
I really liked it.
Yeah, I like it too. I appreciate it. Even faster than I appreciated Hackers, because it took a while for me to warm up to Hackers because it was just so cheesy.
Yeah, you got to like Hackers for how 90s it is, because it's just
right.
So 90s.
That it's just sort of a goulash of 90s stereotypes and tropes within the tech community, and nothing to do with actual, quote-unquote, whatever you want to call hacking.
Yeah. But, you know, it still inspired people to get into hacking, though.
Right. Hacking in the sense of wanting to know more about underlying technology that they're using.
Yeah.
So if you watch Ready Player One, if you watched it before, you probably wouldn't have thought of Facebook at all. But now that you, if you watch it again and you've seen it before, you'll probably think of Facebook as IOI.
Yeah.
Where basically you have an outsider that is taking a cyberpunk idea like Metaverse and just saying like, hey, you know, all you dudes that played for Cadia and Second Life and all these, you know, people that trailblazed in the 90s with virtual reality, come to the Metaverse and buy your condominium and then flip it and make money with NFTs on your wall. And it's like, as soon as I saw it, like, oh, okay, so Facebook is IOI, basically.
I did think of, when they started talking about Metaverse, I did think of Ready Player One. I'm like, oh, so they want it to kind of be like that then.
Yeah. I think that Mark probably saw the video or saw the film. He probably didn't even read the book, and he was just like, "Oh, this
yeah,
is
let's
cool.
Do that.
That's cool. Let's do that.
I will do this.
I will own that.
Yes. What? What is your style? Show me your style. What's that one?
Is Second Life still around?
I don't know. Is Furcadia still around?
Furcadia.
I hear
things about that through Midwest Gaming Classic every once in a while.
Yeah.
The
thing with Furcadia, it was so.
It's furry centric, right? So
it is furry centric, and that's how I found out about furries was through Furcadia. But the thing about Furcadia is it's so. You're basically like, you know, a little figurine that walks around. And
right, and it is an early example of a massively online role-playing game, computer role-playing game system.
Right, it's role-playing.
I remember when I was hearing stuff about that is when they were contrasting and comparing it. I think that was, you know, one of the linchpins of, like, the Neo Habitat project that, you know, Furcadia, I guess, was considered to be one of the early implementations of that. And they're like, well, no, really, we had Habitat first, and there were a couple other intermediary things as well. But, yeah, probably Furcadia probably took off on a large scale.
Right. And I think...
in its heyday.
And this kind of goes into that whole thing where, you know, Captain Hindsight, where you just kind of, like, glom everything together. You know, you say that, I was going to try to make some reference to the 80s, that you glom everything in the 80s, you know, Edie Brickell, Devo, blah, 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 all of it together is the 80s. And I think that people tend to do that with, like, Furcadia, that they equate it with, I will say this, the perverted side of furryism, where it's just all sex stuff, right? And you're a dog or whatever. Okay, but I think Furcadia has a more innocent approach, and it's more about the social user interaction of
right, because there is no direct hookup option like the actual in-person shows.
Right. Yeah, there's no video chat or anything like that. It's basically an avatar as a little, figure that looks like whatever character you've designed yourself to be, your avatar, in interacting with other people in a social sense.
Yeah.
And anything else is all in the human's mind, both people participating or whatever, it's in their mind, versus, an entirely graphic depiction that happens, suddenly someone turned on their video camera and hey, I didn't know you were like 56-year-old dude. What's going on here? I'm just a little kid. So, but, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I think that I'm not going to say that anybody who's into this kind of thing, furries, right, is going to be, I'm not going to taint Furcadia as far as...
Right, you're not going to paint Furcadia as the sort of base stereotype that is sometimes associated with...
Hey, furries, don't cancel me.
Yes.
Don't
cancel furries me. Are fine. You can do what you like. You're consenting adults.
Yeah. But anyways, I'm just trying to defend things like Furcadia that it probably wasn't the idea.
Right.
It's like anytime anybody has an idea for a community,
right? Suddenly,
the community develops, the community owns it, and they will turn it into whatever
They want.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I've never heard of Furcadia, but.
I've heard of it, like I said, in passing, but I had no direct experience with it because I've never, I know people that were into the furry stuff, but I never got into
it was not my thing. I was so naive, and I had just approached it like an innocent kid, and I was just like, wow, it's cool, I'm a cat dude. And I'm talking to people all over the world, sitting on tuffins and just having a conversation.
I remember I first heard about Second Life. I was in college and I was talking to somebody who, they were a friend of mine in college was upset. I'm like, well, what's going on? And she's like, well, my one boyfriend on Second Life found out that I was cheating on him with somebody else from Second Life.
Oh,
he's
wow.
really upset now. And I was like, you're kidding, right? Because she was as upset as if it was like,
right, a betrayal of,
Yeah,
I mean, some people connect in that way.
Yeah.
And they have to deal with it. And...
Well, and I will just say that anything like that, even for me, having chats with people and playing games or whatever on those systems, it was still a real experience to me. I didn't say
right. You're still actually interacting with another person, and
at that point, I didn't really understand. I understood it to be more of like a game. And, eventually I kind of learned, you're actually kind of developing,
And just like to be, once again, we go back to the NPR spot. It's like become real friends.
The thing is, for Furcadia and, the big Minecraft servers, there's no difference really because it's still avatars and it's about how humans behave.
Yep.
And I think for Furcadia, it's just they happen to be animal based characters.
Sure. Yeah.
And that I think that that's kind of what I'm trying to get at is that not all furries are perverts.
Right. I mean, it's more, the original concept is more about that the sort of...
You don't have to be yourself. you can
right. You don't have to be yourself, but it's more like reappropriating what was considered to be child's play, pretending to be an animal into your adulthood. And we all, you know, I mean, whereas that's not really my thing. There are things that I do like that would be considered quite childish, but I enjoy even as an adult.
Okay.
You know, all sorts of children's animation and things like that, things that are creative and clever.
And stuffed pizza.
But so, that's not childish.
Oh my God, look, he's trying to defend it.
That's just self-indulgent.
Okay.
You don't have to be a child to be self-indulgent.
Your parents have to put it together.
My parents don't have to put it together.
Okay.
I would be a little afraid if my parents put it together today.
I guess so, yeah. I guess that's right.
Are we talking about stuffed crust pizza or just stuffed pizza?
We're talking stuffed pizza, which is a variation of pizza. Although that reminds me that I was watching once again a child animation and there was a Chicago pizza commentary in it.
Oh. That gets him every time.
Well, it was hilarious because it's like the protagonist character was, you know, trying to get into a place and he was carrying a pizza in a pizza box and the bouncer is not letting him in and eventually he distracts him and then throws the pizza into the bouncer's face. And the bouncer screams, "Oh, it's Chicago style, and it's not even pizza! Yeah, it's not even real pizza."
If it's Chicago style, it's probably not from Chicago.
Well, speaking of, you know, enjoying.
Well, he had a Brooklyn. The bouncer had a Brooklyn accent, so you know it's New York versus Chicago.
I see.
I actually recently watched an episode of Reading Rainbow that I really loved when I was a kid. But it was funny because they were talking about, you know, this new cutting-edge technology, you know, this biodegradable, all-natural plastic that's the plastic of the future, and we call it PLA.
Oh, wow, okay.
And yeah, I was like, PLA. Oh, wow, this is actually really cool, you know. It was like the very beginning of when they were starting to use PLA, you know, before 3D printers were, you know, ever considered a thing.
Yep.
And now I have, you know, boxes of PLA in the basement. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, that is cool. Yeah, there is some evolution for you right there in fast forwarding. And it that sort of thing, I mean, it's so hard to... And that goes back to the retrospect thing that it's just like, why didn't they do this? Or why didn't they know this? Or like, you can't...
You know everything.
Judge them. Yeah, you can't judge them for all that stuff and not knowing and things like that. I mean, it's and also you can't kick yourself for not knowing at the time.
Right. Yeah.
But,
yeah, hindsight is hindsight for a reason.
Yeah, and again, it goes into that whole thing of like trying to depict a particular time as one thing And I think that for most people that have gone through a situation like that, they wouldn't think of things in a similar way. You know, they wouldn't have put Duran Duran with Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians and call it the 80s. That's the connection I wanted to make. They wouldn't said that they wouldn't take Red Hot Chili Peppers and Devo. Freedom of choice, and put those together and said that's the 80s. It's like, it's real hard.
Well, that's a new millennium mashup waiting to happen.
Right, that's what happens. It's like, it's mashup. So when I was watching Ready Player One, it was just like onslaught of mashup. And the thing is that it seemed to be done with people in the know, and the gameplay for Adventure, which, I'm sorry, that's a spoiler. I mean, the film's been out for a number of years.
Yeah, I know. Get over it.
The book as well. But I thought that, you know, they kept the gameplay for Adventure just as it was on the VCS or 2600.
All the duck, all the time. I mean, dragon.
Ah!
I, I love the Shining scene. That's all I'll say, so I won't give away any spoilers. But that was hilarious.
I think I have to watch The Shining so I can understand.
Yeah.
Here's Johnny.
I've never seen The Shining, so.
Really?
Nope.
You should definitely watch that. It's really
good. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, because what they showed in that film was pretty horrific and scary. Is The Shining as horrific and scary?
It was very scary for its time. Today, it would probably be kind of mild and kind of campy and funny to some degree.
I can remember it being incredibly scary the first.
Like, if you were a kid and you saw that, and, you know, the elevator opens up and the hallway fills with blood, and you watch, you know, Jack descend into madness and, you know, the ghost entourage, you might get a little creeped out.
No, that's definitely one of those movies on my list that I, you know, watch regularly, either once a year or once every couple of years.
Oh, wow.
I love that movie.
It's like The Exorcist. It gets funnier every time I see it.
Hey, you know what? We should have a movie commentary and review show on Open Void. Wouldn't that be awesome?
That'd be interesting.
Yes,
we could do
awesome.
That, yeah, certainly.
Yeah, let's review.
Do a movie watch party and review.
Yes,
you mean,
let's
you mean
review.
Like-
Review
STF 3000.
STF 3000. Let's review Star Wars: The Last Jedi. I wanted in Picard.
The Last
in
Jedi.
Picard. Yes, in Picard on Paramount Plus. I want to review those because have you watched Picard yet?
I have only seen the freebie episode that they fed out, so I'm too cheap to actually subscribe to that stuff. So, unless there is some other outlet, I might not be able to participate in that. But
I've watched the whole first season, and so the second season is going to start pretty soon. But the first season, I'm sorry if this is a spoiler for you guys listening, but holy heck. Why are Data and Picard such good friends? Because they never were.
Well, so I think the background with that is Picard defended him as an individual and not a machine when they attempted to basically take him and treat him as an object. You know, basically the one dude was trying to get him transferred to his research facility so that he could deconstruct him and possibly create another android like him.
Are you talking in the Next Generation?
Yeah, Next Generation episode.
Okay.
There is an episode where there is an issue where Data's rights are sort of violated as an individual. They're like, well, no, you're really a machine. You're owned by the Federation.
That's
and we're
going to,
you know, take you apart so we can figure out, you know, Dr. Noonien's secrets, and Picard comes to the rescue.
Okay, so that's when the Picard Data love starts.
Yes.
Okay. Oh, all right.
That he has to assume some level of responsibility for his being as an individual. He recognizes him not only as a valued crew member, but, you know, a fully actualized, living, thinking being.
Yeah. Data as a Jedi. Though, holy heck. All right. Well, no, that would be fun. Maybe we can pick a series, and then we'll do an Open VoIP night. Not Fridays, because that's Vintage Comp. But we'll pick another night, and that will be we'll discuss and discuss the latest episode. I mean, we could start with. We got 1 minute left. Well, I don't know. What do you guys think? There's enough bullshit out there.
There's enough stuff that we can watch, you know, popular culture-wise, current or otherwise. Like, on my watch list, a friend of mine, I think, mentioned The Locket, and I think that the DVR is going to record that for me next week, and I'm going to watch that. But
what are we at? 40 seconds left.
This has been Vintage Comp with SMJ.
And Jazz Baz.
And next is Open Mic.
And Robert 588, we should have Fred, Robert 588, he's been calling consistently. 30 seconds left, and next, you can be the DJ on a non-radio.
Be the DJ.
You will be the DJ on a non-radio. Just go to anonradio.net and click on DJs. There's some information about Open Mic where you can stream whatever the heck you want. 10 seconds left. You know, we've got an SDF or non-radio time standard now, ntp.sdf.org. Thank you for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.